Hi, I'm Meryl Frank.
And I'm Bob Cudmore.
My name is Jim Kaplan.
Hello. My name is Phyllis Chapman.
My name is Paul Kicks.
Hi, I'm Dr. Matthew Cagle.
Hi, Bob. This is Scott Hefner.
And this is a highlights edition with excerpts from 7 2023 episodes of the Historians Podcast. Unearthed by Meryl Frank tells the story of Meryl's cousin, Franny Winter, a celebrated Yiddish actress in Vilna in Eastern Europe who died in the Holocaust.
This book is partly a cautionary tale, like many Holocaust books are, and they're all important stories to tell. But what is a little bit different about Unearthed is I tell the story, but then I talk about, well, what does this mean to us? How do we live with this? And what do we tell our children? You know, speaking of memorial candles, what is our obligation as parents to tell our children about histories that could be tragic? Hi, I'm Meryl Frank. I'm the author of Unearthed, A Lost Actress, A Forbidden Book, and A Search for Life in the Shadow of the Holocaust. I was always meant to write this book. It was something that was deep inside of me. I grew up with something called, it's an Israeli term, it's called the memorial candle, and that's the person in the family that remembers the history. In my case, I was told the history as far back as I can remember, the history of my family in Europe, where they lived, what the address was, what they did, what their occupations were. But it all abruptly stopped with the war. And after that, all I would hear was that they didn't make it or they're all gone. And so even as a young child, I was interested in what happened. Who were these people? And it was something that stayed with me for a very long time. And I learned a little bit more. I learned shortly before my aunt died that there was a book that described how my cousin died. Now, my cousin was an actress in the Yiddish theater in Vilna, which is now Vilnius, Lithuania. And there was a book. My aunt had a book, and she gave it to me. She said, I want you to have this. I want you to pass it to your children. But don't ever read it.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. In Unearthed, Meryl Frank tells the story of her cousin, Franny Winter, a celebrated Yiddish stage actress in Vilna in Eastern Europe who died in the Holocaust. Meryl Frank was mayor of Highland Park, New Jersey for 10 years. She was appointed to the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women by President Obama in 2009. She works with women around the world on leadership and media issues. You've learned a lot about your family and the Holocaust. How did it come to be that you survived? Your parents, were they in Eastern Europe as well?
You know, my parents were here and my grandparents were here. These are the families of my grandmother, whose name was Meryl, I was named for her, and my grandfather. And I knew about them because my family was very into history. And we had photographs of them from before the war. And my aunt Molly was a history teacher, and she decided that I was going to be the one to learn. And so I would sit with her and pop M&Ms, and she would tell me stories about the family. And I never forgot them.
You were, as you described it, the memorial candle. You were sort of the designated person who was to pay attention to the old days. I mean, did you find your other, siblings or other relatives, were happy to give this job to you, or did they have a similar interest?
Well, it's interesting because I'm the youngest of four daughters, and so you would think that the oldest would have been designated, but my sisters were all given American names. I was given a Yiddish name for my grandmother, and I think that my aunt saw me as, in some strange way, a reincarnation of my grandmother, and she wanted me to be the one to know the stories. My sisters know little bits. But, when you're writing about history, and I'm sure you know this, there are different perspectives. And so when I started writing the book, I said to my sisters, how often did our aunt visit us? And one sister said every week, one sister said every other week, and one sister said once a month. I said, do you see how we remember things differently?
Sure.
In this book, I'm going to tell my story and the way that I saw it.
This is the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore. We have stories for you from Focus on History, my weekly column, which now runs in the Daily Gazette and the Amsterdam Recorder. This is a column that ran in the month of April called Boxing, a Popular Sport in Amsterdam. Amsterdam was a boxing mecca in the 1930s and 1940s, a legacy of boxing matches arranged for soldiers at the city's National Guard Armory, now a boutique hotel called Amsterdam Castle. Fights also were staged at Lanzi's Arena on Bridge Street by the family who still operates an Amsterdam restaurant called Lorenzo's South Side. This particular column came to be because of a visit Miss Audrey and I paid to Lorenzo's to have dinner. And one of the Lanzi brothers, I think it was Larry, came out with a book or a scrapbook about all the fights that used to take place at Lanzi's, but, you know, not barroom brawls. These were prize fights, boxing matches, which were held at something called Lanzi's Arena. I probably could have checked into this to be sure, but my hunch is Lanzi's Arena was outdoors, that they had the fights take place in the outdoor ring. So in addition to the National Guard Armory, they also had fights at Lanzi's Arena, and there were bouts held at the former junior high school gym on Guy Park Avenue. Other people in Amsterdam were also involved, or many other people, in the boxing frenzy, if you will. Sammy and Jimmy Pep, who owned a West End restaurant, trained fighters and were friends with German heavyweight Max Schmeling. Schmeling had fought Joe Louis in two bouts in the 1930s, and he was fighting for Germany. So his loss was kind of a blow to Adolf Hitler. A trainer who was in Amsterdam was named Jojo Zeno. I mean, there were other trainers, but Jojo Zeno was especially well-known. He had training quarters on East Main Street. For many years in the 1990s, school teacher George Lazaro wrote a weekly history article in the Amsterdam Recorder called A Bit of Reminiscing and frequently discussed boxing. In a 1999 interview for the WMHT-TV documentary Carpet City, I asked Lazaro why boxing thrived in 1930s Amsterdam. He said, quote, "That's a good question. All I can say is that we had so many good athletes here, great athletes who were proficient in basketball, baseball, softball, hockey. Boxing was just another sport." Lazaro died at age 91 in 2012. He was a fighter himself in Amsterdam back in the day. He was trained by his friend Buddy Benoit, who became a professional fighter. Benoit had been trained in Amsterdam by Jojo Zeno. Lazaro said, "Buddy Benoit and I went to school together. He became a professional fighter. He fought Jake LaMotta and barely lost. He was that good." Benoit began his boxing career in 1936 when he was 16, according to an article written by Lazaro. In a span of 11 years, Benoit amassed a total of 120 amateur and 76 professional fights. In 1939, Benoit won a decision over another one of Amsterdam's great fighters, welterweight William Sailor Baron. An estimated 1,600 people jammed Lanzi's Arena to watch that match. Sailor Baron served in the U.S. Navy in World War II. Lazaro wrote that Baron took part in an estimated 500 fights, including bouts when he was serving in the U.S. Navy. Our New York City correspondent, Jim Kaplan, reports on how Harlem was economically developed in the early 1900s by realtor Philip Payton.
And he noticed that rents in these what would be considered luxury houses in North Harlem were not that much higher than they were for the slum areas of Hell's Kitchen. So he went through his contacts and he said to people, well, I can get you a better place. You can live in Harlem in the luxury area of the Jeffrey Jewish area. And they must have said, are you kidding? We can't live there. And he said, yes, I can.
My name is Jim Kaplan. I'm a longtime Manhattan walking tour historian. I'm also the chairman of the Lower Manhattan Historical Association, and I'm also a past vice president of the Temple of Universal Judaism. Today, my talk relates to really the Black Jewish Alliance Against Discrimination. It was perhaps influenced by my going to our Passover Seder, which really is the story of the flight of the Jews out of slavery in Egypt 4,000 years ago. And I've always wondered why we don't tell another perhaps equally interesting story about the fight here in New York City 100 years ago.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Our New York City correspondent Jim Kaplan is with us. His story today explains how Jews and Blacks came together in New York City, among other things, to develop the community of Harlem, but also to combat prejudice. You talk about Joseph and Jesse Seligman and Philip Payton and the Black Jewish Alliance in the first decade of the 20th century and how they revolutionized race relations in New York City. How does this story from 100 years ago relate to the Passover, which took place thousands of years ago?
Well, let me start with Joseph and Jesse Seligman, who were actually a little before Payton. They were Jewish immigrants to New York from Germany, and they had a prominent textile. They were originally itinerant peddlers and turned into a fairly prominent textile firm around right before the Civil War, and they bought an extensive factory in Brooklyn in 1859. And when the Civil War hit in the 1861, the Union Army needed a lot of uniforms and things like that. And they were, after the defeats at the Battle of Bull Run, there were many merchants who were unwilling to finance them, but the Seligmans were not. They fell all in to finance the Union Army, firstly with uniforms, and then later they branched out into to finance and to raise funds for the Union Army. So right after the Civil War, Joseph and Jesse Seligman were the most prominent Jewish businessmen on Wall Street and really were credited as being financiers of the Northern effort in the Civil War and close associates of Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant. They were, in many ways, the most prominent Jews in New York and considered to be very patriotic. And every summer they would bring their families with a residue of servants to stay at the Grand Union Hotel in Saratoga Springs, New York, which was probably the most prominent resort in New York State. However, and they considered themselves to be as American as apple pie and great supporters of the United States, and it never occurred to them that they would face anti-Semitism, even though at the time there were hundreds of thousands of Jewish immigrants coming from Russia fleeing the pogroms. But from their point of view, they were at the pinnacle of New York and American society. However, in 1879, the new manager of the Saratoga Hotel, a man named Henry Hilton, announced to them that they couldn't stay there because they had the Grand Union Hotel had a new policy.
that henceforth no Jews would be allowed to stay there. Mm. The Seligmans were absolutely outraged and took out newspaper articles denouncing this policy. And although their effort attracted some considerable support from prominent Christian clergymen, such as Henry Ward Beecher, in essence, Judge Hilton stood his ground, said that he could rent to anybody, he could have anybody he wants stay or not stay at his hotel, and many of his customers and many of his weren't happy about having Jews like the Seligman stay there, and therefore the policy would be that no Jews would be allowed.
Hello, my name is Phyllis Chapman. I am a trustee with the Friends of the Bennington Battlefield, which is located in the town of Hoosick, just over the Vermont-New York state line. We are a group that supports and helps with interpretation of the Bennington Battlefield, which is a New York State historic site. It is the site where an important, small but important battle took place in the summer of 1777. It was part of the campaign from General John Burgoyne as he traveled that summer through the Champlain Valley, down through Lake George and Fort Edward, with the initial intent of meeting up with the army of General Howe down in New York City. The idea was to mass a large army in the state of New York and pursue the war from there. In August of 1777, General Burgoyne in Fort Edward was facing serious supply problems. He had to get all of his supplies from Canada at this point and was desperately in need of ammunition, food, but particularly horses. Hmm. Under Burgoyne, they had a large contingent of German soldiers that were leased soldiers, and among them were dragoons under General Friedrich Reisdiesel. And they were unmounted. So they decided that they would try to do a sweep through Vermont and Massachusetts at one point to try to forage for themselves and get some horses, cattle, and then bring them back. It was a tall order.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. The 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States of America will be celebrated starting in 2026, I believe. But some events are already underway, some commemorations. The folks in the area of Bennington, Vermont, for example, are getting ready and, in fact, will hold programs about the Battle of Bennington starting this year. And we're on the line with Phyllis Chapman of the Friends of the Bennington Battlefield. You've already established this, but I guess I can't resist the phrase. It's not a trick question. Where was the Battle of Bennington fought?
Battle of Bennington was actually fought in the town of Hoosick, which is in New York State. It is roughly 4 miles from the border of Vermont and New York State, which at the time was considered rather fluid by people on both sides. But it was actually held in this little hamlet of Wallumsack rather than Bennington, although Bennington was the original objective.
Paul Kix says a photograph convinced him to write a book about the history of race relations.
And I thought to myself, well, not just that photo, but the surrounding campaign might be a book project. And that book project very quickly became a family project of sorts, because I really thought that perhaps if I told this story of Birmingham, which, by the way, had never been told, this is the most shocking thing to me as I began to research it more, the civil rights canon might be as deep as any in American letters. However, there is not one, until this book, there is not one book that just focuses on those 10 weeks in Birmingham.
My name is Paul Kix. I am a writer and author, and my latest book is called You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live. It's a long title, but it's a quote that comes from Fred Shuttlesworth, who is one of the leaders of Project Confrontation, which is the focus of my book. That focus are the 10 weeks in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama, that I believe not only changed the course of the civil rights movement, but changed the course of America.
Fort Ticonderoga curator Matthew Cagle says this season will focus on the year 1760.
We found the pandemic to be an opportunity for us. You know, it challenged a lot of us in the field to think about what we're doing, and we were able to pivot, you know, in part because of that, but in part because we had set the groundwork in our strategic plan for digital opportunities. There's more available online than ever through our online collections database, where you can explore over 30,000 artifacts in the collection remotely from your home at this point, to educational programs, videos, and other things through our Center for Digital History. But even in 2020, during the pandemic, we were able to open the site. We had a season, although it was curtailed for obvious reasons, and had certain constraints on it. We have the benefit of having a nearly 2,000-acre historic site. Hi, I'm Dr. Matthew Cagle. I am the curator here at Fort Ticonderoga, where for 2023, we have an exciting series of public programs, events, living history opportunities, exhibitions, and other things going on surrounding a particularly interesting, although not often well-known, year in Fort Ticonderoga's history as part of our broader program to explore a different year of Fort Ticonderoga's history every year we are open to the public.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Matthew Cagle joins us, curator of collections at Fort Ticonderoga, one of the oldest and most significant historic sites and museums in North America. Originally from Vermont, Dr. Cagle earned a doctorate at Bard Graduate Center in New York. You started talking about this year's special theme at Fort Ticonderoga. This is the second time, I believe, you've joined us from the fort. And when you were on the last time, you talked about that year's theme. But this year, I understand you're taking a look at the year 1760. What was significant about 1760?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for over a decade now, Fort Ticonderoga has explored a different year of the fort's history. Every year we are open to the public, and this year we have reached 1760, which, if you're not familiar with what happened at Fort Ticonderoga in 1760, it comes as no surprise to me. It's not one of the better-known years in Fort Ticonderoga's sweeping narrative, and yet it's very important because it's the final year of active campaigning against the French, at least in the northern part of North America, during what we know as the French and Indian War. So an army is assembling in the Champlain Valley over the spring of 1760, only one part of a three-pronged offensive led by General Jeffrey Amherst. One arm, as I say, was launched from the Champlain Valley, particularly from Crown Point, would head up, or rather down, Lake Champlain to the north, going against French positions at Île-aux-Noix to drive towards the city of Montreal. And two other wings of the army, one leaving from Quebec City and the other under Amherst's direct command, went out the Mohawk, out into Lake Ontario, and then down the St. Lawrence River, all of which were planned to converge around the city of Montreal to force its surrender. And remarkably and incredibly, they did. Within just days of each other, these three armies converged around the city of Montreal with very little communication between them, facing the siege of French fortifications, rapids and naval and land engagements on all sides, and overwhelmed the French defenders, who were forced to capitulate. And ultimately, it's the end of the campaign of 1760, which confirms that New France will no longer be a French colony, but will be part of the British Empire.
Hi, Bob. This is Scott Hefner. I'm the site manager at Old Fort Johnson in Fort Johnson, New York. I'm here at the home of Sir William Johnson, who built this house in 1749. He was the British Commissioner for Indian Affairs. And Old Fort Johnson was an important military post and Indian council site from 1754 until 1763.
This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Yes, Scott Hefner is with us. What does it mean to be the site manager of this historic place?
I jokingly tell people it's better than having a real job. I live here on site, and I do pretty much everything. I manage the tours and design exhibits and set up for our events and more mundane things like paint the trim and mow the lawn. And it's a little bit of everything every day, which makes it interesting because there's something to do different every day.
I go back with Old Fort Johnson myself some decades because when I was in high school, I knew Sam Canavan, who lived at the fort as you do. Actually, I knew his daughter, Joan Canavan, who still with us. In fact, she's married a man named John Loss, and I mean, there's a whole other story. So I remember going over there. It seemed odd to me at the time, you know, this because in their case, it was a whole family of people living at Old Fort Johnson.
Yep, they had the whole. We have a caretaker's house in back that was built for the caretakers, and Sam's family was one a line of people that had been here since starting in 1906. I kind of live here. I live here by myself. When I came along, the caretakers had the whole house in back, and just before I came along, they decided we needed a visitor center and a sort of a gift shop, so they sort of relegated me to the upstairs. But we kind of share the house now.
Mm-hmm. When did you come along? How long have you actually lived there?
Well, this past November, I celebrated 20 years here at Fort Johnson. Seems like a long time.
I would think so. But it seems to me it's been productive. You've written other books while you've lived there, and you do all this stuff to keep the old Fort Johnson going. It's, I don't know, it's not unique probably by any means, but the thing I like about old Fort Johnson is it's different from a, let's say, state historic site, which is the other major Johnson home, Johnson Hall. I mean, that's operated by the state of New York, isn't it?
Correct. And we're a private, non-for-profit owned by the Montgomery County Historical Society, which is a member organization with a board of trustees. And I always say we've been here longer. We opened to the public in July of 1906, and Johnson Hall didn't open until the summer of 1907.
And that's the conclusion of our latest highlights episode on the Historians Podcast. We're now up to podcast episode number 480, and we expect to have a big celebration when we get to number 500. We haven't quite figured out what number 500 is going to be about. If you have any ideas, send me an email, bobcudmore@yahoo.com. And send me an email if you'd like to receive our email blast. It comes out every weekend, and it tells you about the latest podcast, my latest column in the Daily Gazette, and also in the Amsterdam Recorder. And this, you go to a different location on the internet, but if you could go to our website, bobcudmore.com, you will find a button that will take you to our GoFundMe campaign. Yes, we're trying to raise money for our Historians Podcast this year. We'd like to raise $7,000, but it's been slow going. We hope you can make a donation. Any size is appreciated, be large or small, and you can even donate anonymously. And you can also donate by sending a check to me, Bob Cudmore, to 125 Horseman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. This has been the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore.